Good afternoon and welcome to this encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, we're going to listen to a conversation I had last spring with Elaine Weiss. Her latest book tells the inspirational story of the civil rights activists who offered citizenship classes to African Americans throughout the South from 1955 through 1970. The story centers around Septima Clark, whom Martin Luther King Jr. called the mother of the movement, and three others who worked tirelessly and at great personal cost to develop a system of secret schools. Esau Jenkins, Bernice Robinson, and a white activist, Miles Horton, are not household names of the civil rights movement, but this book makes the compelling case that their importance cannot be overstated. This is Elaine Weiss's third book of narrative history. She's written about the Woman's Land Army in World War I. Her book, The Woman's Hour, about the suffragist movement, is the source material for the hit Broadway musical, Suffs. This book is called Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. Elaine Weiss joined me in Studio A. Good to see you.
Good to see you again, Tom.
And congratulations on this book. It's really, really eye-opening in so many ways. It begins on the day that the Brown versus Board of Education decision is announced. And you remind us that Brown v. Board is actually a sort of compilation of five different cases. Tell us what was involved in that group of cases.
Sure. The Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas was its official name. It was the decision was announced in May of 1954. But what had preceded that was a set of five different cases that were that came from five different jurisdictions, one of them in South Carolina. And I followed that case especially because it involved many of my characters that I then follow. But what's so interesting about it is that these were early efforts to challenge the segregation rules, the Jim Crow segregation rules, which were law in many of the southern states. And these were brought by the NAACP. Thurgood Marshall was involved in several of them. And this was the first time. It wasn't the beginning of stirrings of a movement or the first time that the community was trying to fight back against the segregation and the unequal schooling for Black children. But it becomes a catalyst. It becomes this moment when the government, for the really first time, says, we're on your side on this. And this separate is not equal. It never can be. This is now overthrowing the Plessy decision of the late 19th century. And so that's been the basis of rationalizing segregation. Oh, they're separate, but they're equal. Well, they were never equal. And so this is a way that there is an enormous sense of possibility. Now, what we learn is that the Brown decision was never really enforced well. And it took, in some cases, a decade or more to actually desegregate schools. But I chose that as the opening because it's a moment when the movement gets sparked and there is a great sense of pushing forward.
And Septima Clark and others begin a series of classes to teach people, in some cases, basic literacy, how to write their name, and how to read the rules around voting, how to read the Constitution of South Carolina or other places. So tell us about these schools, which were done in secret. The first one happened in the back room of a grocery store. I mean, it was like the grocery store was a front for these classes.
Yes. What I try to show is how a group of activists come together. They're ordinary people. Septima Clark is a school teacher. She teaches in elementary school. She's been teaching for 40 years. She's fired from her job because she refuses to renounce her membership in the NAACP, which was in South Carolina, where she lived, which was called subversive. And there was a new law that said no municipal or state employee could belong to the NAACP.
Yeah, and she had joined it in secret even. She didn't tell her parents about it.
Exactly. Yeah, right. She put her dues in an upturned umbrella. It was all very secret because the NAACP was pursuing these landmark decisions in the courts. And they'd been doing it for years. And the white establishment in the South thought this was very dangerous. And so they tried to outlaw them. Septima Clark refuses to renounce her membership, and she's fired after 40 years of teaching. She goes to becomes a staff member of something called the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But there, she also brings some of her NAACP activist friends from Charleston to this mountaintop retreat center, Highlander, in Tennessee. And there they begin talking about what's needed. What's this next step? Besides desegregation in the schools, what would lead to a sense of community Black power? And that is voting. You know, voting, even though the 15th Amendment in 1870 said Black men were entitled to vote, and the 19th Amendment in 1920 said all women over the age of 21 were voters, in the South, these had been thwarted by Jim Crow laws. And so it was very dangerous and very uncertain that people could vote and Black people could vote. And one of the reasons is that there were all these obstacles put in front of them. There were poll taxes, which were onerous. They were a lot of money for a sharecropper to pay to be able to vote. There were literacy tests. And these were not just signing your name and reading ABC. This was, at least in South Carolina, having to read and interpret sections of the Constitution of the state, which were written in arcane and legalistic language. And you were to interpret this to the satisfaction of the registrar, who, of course, was never satisfied by what you said. So what this did was, how could they break through? How could they even get, especially rural people, to be able to vote? And they come up with this idea of citizenship schools. At first, they're called literacy schools because, again, as a function of the separate but unequal schools, most of the Black population in rural areas were never able to learn to read and write. They couldn't go to school for more than a few weeks a year because even as children, they were sent into the fields. So most of the population is functionally illiterate. And what Septima Clark, as an educator, says is this can be taught. And so she is. She develops a curricula, and Esau Jenkins, who is this kind of fabulous small businessman on a sea island,
himself with a fourth grade education, lives in this little island that's off the coast of Charleston.
Exactly,
and is an incredible organizer.
Yeah, and he says, "My people need to be able to read and write." In order to be able to vote, we won't be able to progress at all until the white establishment recognizes us, meaning we have some power and we can vote.
Yeah, and you write that, you know, along with the capacity to vote comes this sense of empowerment. You say that it's a great sense of empowerment and liberation that comes when people can see themselves as citizens. It's more than just the functionality of being able to spell and write your name and even read the South Carolinian Constitution, but it's this notion of a self-image that says, yes, my vote counts, I count, I'm a person that's a citizen of this state. So, you know, voting is so essential to the civil rights movement. Of course, the Voting Rights Act gets passed in 1965, which is a big achievement. But even with that being passed, people had to be able to physically do it. And these schools were a big first step in helping that happen.
Absolutely. And that sense of empowerment, of agency, of learning to be what Septima Clark would call a first-class citizen. You're not second-class. You're not third-class anymore, even though you've been told that all your life. You're a first-class citizen. And one of the things they learn in these classes is not just how to read and write. And they have to, at the beginning, be taught how to hold a pencil, because they've never held a writing implement before. And so there's a really, I find, very moving scene of these adults with strong hands, because they've done manual labor all their lives, and they try to hold the pencil, but they're so nervous and eager that the pencil snap in their hands because they are trying so hard. Septima Clark calls this being ready from within. You have to be ready to fight for your rights. You have to be ready for liberation. And you have to be ready and know what your responsibilities of citizenship are. You have privileges, but you also have responsibilities. And so along with teaching the three R's, and they learned arithmetic too, so they wouldn't be cheated, so they didn't have to write an X or ask their employer to read documents to them. They felt like a real adult, a real person. They could be 75 years old and still have this. And she said there's a gleam in their eye. But they also were taught what's in that Constitution and what's in the U.S. Constitution. You have rights, and you have all the rights that white people have. And don't let anybody tell you you don't. And they learned Black history. So there was a sense of pride in their achievements. And they learned songs for solidarity. So it was this whole package. It was literacy, but it was also citizenship and also personal empowerment.
Yeah, and it spreads class by class, community by community. By the time the freedom schools stop, well, people use that term freedom schools to mean a whole lot of different things, but these literacy and citizenship classes ended in like 15 years later, 1970 or so. Mm-hmm. You know, there were how many across the country, across
900.
The South?
900.
Yeah.
Now, we should also make clear that these aren't little brick and mortar schools. These are not what we would call schoolhouses.
These are rooms.
These are informal peer-to-peer classes. These were volunteer teachers in every community who would go train with Septima Clark, learn how to build one of these schools. And when I say build, it was finding a place. And sometimes it was your kitchen table. Sometimes it was the back of a grocery store, which was where the behind the shelves in a room where there were no windows, purposefully. Sometimes they were in beauty parlors after hours and they closed the curtains. Sometimes they were in funeral parlors or in mechanic shops. And so they're very informal. These were your neighbors teaching you who might be barely literate themselves, but they were taught how to teach. And then they learned how to organize. You got your certificate graduating from the citizenship schools. You were taken to the registrar to take the test. You were also joined a citizens club or a voting club. And so you see the building of the grassroots, which would then become the movement as it moves across the South. So it was so much more. It was personal and it was political.
Yeah, and it worked, you know, hand in hand with the national movement that, you know, Dr. King and his fight for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And we'll talk about that interweaving. I mean, there's some very well-known civil rights iconic names that were affiliated with the Highlander School and with these citizen schools, Rosa Parks being among them, and many others. We'll talk about that after a quick break. Elaine Weiss, she's the author of Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. And we'll have more on the other side of a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday.
Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, we're listening to a conversation I had last spring with the Baltimore-based author Elaine Weiss about her fascinating book that tells the story of four little-known civil rights activists in the 1950s and 60s who started citizenship schools, a system of secret gathering places where Black Southerners could learn the literacy skills they needed to be able to register to vote. It's called Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. Our program was pre-recorded, so we can't take any calls or online comments today. So, Elaine, let's talk a little bit about Septima Clark. She marries this guy that her parents didn't approve of. She ends up moving in with him and his family. They have a child. And he dies quite suddenly. So she's a widow at a very young age, and an incredible figure, historical figure. What's important to know about Septima Clark, one of those names of the civil rights movement that's not a household name, but certainly should be?
I think so. Septima Clark is such a fascinating woman. She is very tender, and very fierce. And she will not abide having her family or her people disrespected as they are in the South. She's the daughter of a slave, a man who had been enslaved in his younger years. And her mother, who grew up in Haiti and in a Black community where the kind of racism, because it was a Black majority, Black governed country at the time, she did not experience the kind of degradation that she experienced when she came back to Charleston when she was young. So her parents instill in her a sense of things are not right. And you should stand up for yourself. And Septima is a gifted student, but her parents are very poor. But she is able to get a good education. She goes to the most celebrated private Black high school, the Avery Normal School, which taught generations of teachers and leaders for the Black community. And she wants to be a teacher. And she's sent off on her first assignment because Black teachers were not allowed to teach in Charleston, even in the Black schools. They were sent off into the hinterlands, and she works on it's not remote, it's only about 15 miles from Charleston, but it took 9 hours to get there on a little putt-putt motorboat that she has to take to get through the marshes to John's Island. And this will become an important place for her and for the movement, because there she makes these friendships that will become, allow her to go back there and work with people like Esau Jenkins, who is a native of John's Island and really believes in the advancement of his people. And she enters the movement as an educator. And she works at Highlander for quite a few years, develops this incredible program. But she's also, she pushes kind of gently but fiercely. She pushes Miles Horton, who is the director of Highlander, to open up to not just the Black intelligentsia, who had often come to Highlander to discuss racial issues, but to look at the common people. She really believed in the power and the good judgment of the rural, the unlettered, the poor. And John Lewis comes to Highlander. He's 19 years old. He's a seminarian in Nashville at the American Baptist Theological Seminary.
And this is before the formation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Yes, this is he's still a student. He's taking nonviolent training classes with Reverend James Lawson in the basement of a church there. And Lawson brings his students to Highlander to have a weekend retreat and to debate things. And for the first time, John Lewis eats with white people at a table, because Highlander was always integrated. And the person who impresses him most is Septima Clark. And again, she's old enough to be his grandmother. At the time, she's 56 or 7 at this point. And she is, he said that she understood that the movement was not going to be run by elites. It was going to be powered by poor Black people who would rise up and would demand their rights. People
so we have Dr. King et al. Working at the sort of the top-down level, but the Highlander School and these Citizen Education Project schools working from the ground up, which is a really interesting
exactly
pairing.
And she's always pushing and saying, you know, you have to listen to the ground, to the grassroots. You have to listen. You have to respect these poor people. And she gives some rather sharp lessons to King, to others in the movement, like Andy Young, who she works closely with, who were used to working with educated people. And she said, well, the uneducated people can teach us a lot.
The book is Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. The author is my guest, Elaine Weiss. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. So, Elaine, we've talked about Septima Clark, Esau Jenkins. There's a beautician named Barbara Robinson who's involved. And you mentioned Miles Horton, who's the person who started this Highlander school, this Highlander retreat center. Septima Clark, Esau Jenkins, Barbara Robinson, Black activists, very committed to their work. Miles Horton called himself a radical hillbilly. He grew up poor in the hills of Tennessee, a white guy. He and his wife, Zilphia, started this retreat center. And as you say, it was integrated, which at the time was literally illegal, and put the Highlander School on the radar screen of the FBI right from the beginning, from the 1930s. I mean, they took a look at this. But he brings all of these people together. They do training and stuff. And these people included people like Rosa Parks came, which was a stretch for her. She had had to move from Alabama to Michigan because of the notoriety she was enjoying and having to endure after her famous, sitting on the bus in 1955. So there are lots of people coming through from the national movement. But the Highlander School stayed very local, didn't it? It stayed very grassroots.
It did. It, as you said, people like John Lewis comes as a young student and is dedicated to Highlander for the rest of his life. He supported them. Rosa Parks comes. She's 42 or 44 years old when she comes in the summer of 1955. This is before she gives up her seat. And she's been an activist in Montgomery for many years. She's secretary of the NAACP chapter there. She runs the youth council, but she's very frustrated and she's very depressed about conditions. And her friends say, go to this place, Highlander. Maybe you'll you know, get some encouragement. And she's very nervous. Again, first time she's ever sat at a table with white people. She refuses to speak. She's so scared of speaking in an integrated setting. And Septima Clark goes to her dorm room and tries to draw her out, tries to give her some sense of security that the white people are not going to report her to her bosses at the department store where she's a seamstress. And towards the end of the 10 days or 2 weeks that Rosa Parks is there, she begins to trust the people, her classmates and Septima Clark. She asks Septima to accompany her back to Montgomery, at least as far as Atlanta, because she's nervous traveling by herself. And she forges a deep relationship with Septima Clark and looks to her as a model. And 3 months later, Mrs. Parks refuses
to give up her seat on the bus.
And she gives Highlander full credit for stiffening her spine.
Yeah. And forgive me, I think I obscured the timeline there, but it's later on, of course, that she ends up moving to Detroit, et cetera. But she stayed very much active and in touch with the people at Highlander. The personal sacrifice that all of the people, I mean, there are a number of teachers who were fired from their jobs, like Septima Clark was, and they ended up working in the Citizen Education Project schools because they were good at teaching. They had that pedagogically, they knew how to do it. But you know, Septima Clark not only lost her job, she lost her pension. And that wasn't restored until years and years later, when people, you know, began to redress the incredible injustice that had been visited on her. There were these things called the White Citizens Councils that would publish names of people who were involved in civil rights activism, and their employers would then fire them from their jobs. I mean, we hear about Bull Connor. We hear about the Edmund Pettus Bridge, as well we should. We hear about the Children's March in Birmingham. We hear about these, you know, high-profile things, but there was on a daily basis indignities and economic hardship. You write about a grocer who had a store that he lost his business because he was helping with the citizen education efforts. It's so important to be reminded of the personal investment that each of these people had, hundreds and thousands of people.
I totally agree. That was something that was very shocking to read about when you realize how many hundreds of thousands of Black citizens were put in danger and knew the risks, but believed in democracy so completely that they were willing to do it. And I think what shocked me was the institutional nature of what they were facing. So you mentioned White Citizens Councils, which were at the local level. And they usually, these were white supremacist, segregationist, preserving organizations that grew up right after the Brown decision to stall and repress any kind of civil rights activity. And usually the mayor of your town belonged to it, your state representative, your congressman, your senator in Washington, all the local bankers and lawyers and doctors, the elite white establishment belonged to these. Again, they used their power, their political power and their economic power, so that if you even attempted to register to vote, and usually you were not accepted. But if you were even tried, by the time you got home, the registrar would have called your employer and told them this person tried to register to vote. You were evicted from your house. And there's incredible chronicle of tent cities where whole communities of Black people who had tried to vote were ejected from their sharecropper cabins and had to live in the mud in tents for 2 years.
Just for trying to register to vote.
Exactly, exactly. This is what, and not one of them took their names off that registration list. They were persistent. They were resilient. They were brave. And you also lost your job. The loan on your truck got pulled. Your cotton wouldn't be milled at the white-owned refinery for cotton. It was called the squeeze, and it was employed on every community that tried, that attempted some sort of civil rights activity. And then at the state level, there were segregation preservation organizations with names like the Sovereignty Council. And these were run by the governors, and these would work with the state legislatures to promulgate laws that would make it illegal for lawyers to assist in civil rights cases. And we're seeing echoes of that right now.
You write that during the summer of 1955, there's a small town, farming town called Ellery. It's about 75 miles northwest of Charleston. And they filed a petition with the NAACP to integrate the school district. And virtually all of the parents who were involved in that petition were fired from their jobs, evicted from their homes. So there was this coordinated, as you just described, this coordinated economic clampdown on the black community. There was never a complete consensus and agreement about how to respond to all of this. I mean, even the notion of having an integrated place like Highlander, which was training teachers to go out and do these literacy classes. There was a black contingent that thought, you know, do we really want to be involved with white people? There was a white contingent that said, you know, are we really being helpful here? We tend to think back on the civil rights movement as this, you know, beautiful graph that, you know, just heads north the whole time, heads up with the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act and stuff. But there were plenty of conversations about that. One of the things that you write about is the importance of music. I mean, the song We Shall Overcome originated kind of at the Highlander School. This is where people first started singing it together on a regular basis.
Yes, that was one of the most the fun parts of the history for me to write. The song that we know as We Shall Overcome, its basis is in a Baptist hymn of the 19th century. It gets, you know, there are all kinds of antecedents of where the tune comes from and the words come from. But in the 1940s, it was taken up by a group of black women who worked in a cigar factory in Charleston, and they were striking in the tobacco factory. And they started singing this song, or a version of this song, which was very religious. It was, you know, I will, the original words are something like, I will overcome, I will wear the crown like him. And they change it up, and they make a fight song out of it, a slow dirge that they'd sing at the end of every picketing day. And they're invited to come to Highlander for some R&R after this long, bitter strike. And they sing the song for Zilphia Horton, Miles Horton's wife, who has established Highlander and has brought the cultural program. She has a really rich program of bringing local cultures in. And she also is a trained musician and musicologist. And she goes out and she loves to bring back the old songs from all of Appalachia, the black gospels, stuff in the churches and in the mines. And she hears the song. She hears the striking women here bring the song. And she's struck by the power of it. It's a little hard to sing the way it's structured. And so she works on it with them. And she starts singing it on the picket line. And she starts singing it at Highlander. And she teaches it to her friend Pete Seeger, who often comes to Highlander to learn new repertory He brings it north to the coffee houses and the campuses in the north. Alan Lomax from the Library of Congress is very interested in these, and he gets involved. And it gets starts getting published in the late 40s, early 50s. And it's sung at Highlander every night as a sort of rouse that sense. Tom, you know this better than anyone, the power of melded voices together and what that can do to the spirit. And so this is part of the whole learning process at Highlander. And it is it begins to be sung at protest meetings. And when the first sit-ins happen.
And there it goes. It just takes off from there.
It just takes off.
And then you have Pete Seeger and a guy named Guy Carawan, who was part of the Highlander artistic staff, if you will, took it to the Newport Folk Festival and other, you know, really high-profile places. Of course, it was sung at the March on Washington in 1963. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and we'll talk more about Spell Freedom, the underground schools that built the civil rights movement. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us for this encore edition of Midday, we're listening to a conversation I had last spring with the author Elaine Weiss. We're talking about her latest book, Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. It tells the story of Septima Clark, a widowed teacher, Esau Jenkins, a businessman from a small island off the coast of South Carolina, Bernice Robinson, a beautician, and Miles Horton, a self-described radical hillbilly. They and others built a system of 900 citizenship schools in the 1950s and 60s in 11 different southern states, in which more than 7,000 literacy and voting rights classes were offered to African Americans, who were the first to overcome the tremendous Jim Crow barriers to voting. It is an important story, well told. Because our program was pre-recorded, we aren't able to take any new calls or online comments today. When we spoke at the end of April, a caller named Michael joined us.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to your guests. Thank you for highlighting this particular book and topic. I hope that I'm not changing the topic at all, but I felt like in this context that it's important to understand that some of the a lot of the exhibits that are being removed from the Smithsonian Institution are specifically on resistance of Black people to Jim Crow and the policies that were going on during that time. So, or throughout the 20th century, it's the actual history of our resistance that's being removed out of that museum.
Yeah,
and it's so important for your author to continue to highlight this topic and continue to write it. And I want to thank her for doing the book. My wife is an avid reader of historical novels and historical books, and I'm definitely going to let her know about the event tonight. And just thank you and continue your work.
Okay. Well, thanks, Michael. I appreciate the call. And Elaine Weiss, you were booked to do a presentation about this book, Spell Freedom, at the Carter Library in Georgia, in Atlanta, that's run by the National Park Service. And that invitation was rescinded. You were disallowed from speaking about it as part of the assault on DEI. You wrote a piece in the Atlantic Magazine about it.
Yes. I first want to thank Michael, because I totally agree that one of the things that is very disturbing about the attitudes of the actions of the present administration is an attempt to erase what they call uncomfortable history. This is a very dangerous idea. And I'm trying valiantly to bring stories like this to the public and make sure we don't forget. We must learn from this. And there are great lessons for right now in how ordinary citizens can organize and press for change.
Do you know why your invitation to speak at the Carter Library was rescinded? Did they tell you specifically, or do we have to infer?
It was not specific. They didn't say you're being cut because of this, but it had already been approved before the present administration took office in January. It was advertised. It was on the website, and then my publisher was notified that it had basically not won approval again from the new administration. That all programs, and this was under the National Archives and Record Administration.
Oh, excuse me, not the Park Service.
Exactly,
right.
But yeah. That's fine.
And of course, Mr. Trump is on record as not being a fan of the archives.
Yes, and he had just fired the Archivist of the United States, mm-hmm. Colleen Shogan, in retribution for that, and installed, I think Marco Rubio is the de facto head of NARA right now. But clearly, a new ideological purity test had been imposed. And my book, along with a book on homelessness and a book about climate change, which were all scheduled to be featured at the Carter Library, was canceled. And New York Times did a story, the Atlantic Constitution, and it was clear, and I don't blame the staff at the Carter Library, but clearly this had come from the top.
We have an email from David. Let's not forget that Julius Rosenwald, the Jewish partner of Mr. Sears of Sears and Roebuck stores, donated his considerable fortune to build more than 5,300 schools in the Jim Crow South for black children between 1919 and the mid-1930s. Partnering with Booker T. Washington, Mr. Rosenwald financed the construction of more than 5,300 schools, including three here in Maryland. Now, the term freedom school is used, you know, in a blanket way, but the schools that you're writing about here are separate and distinct from the ones that Mr. Rosenwald built.
Yes. The Rosenwald schools is a fascinating, wonderful story. And there's a wonderful documentary about that by Aviva Kempner, which everyone should see. These were a great philanthropic program where Mr. Rosenwald gave money to partner with communities, with black communities, and the parents themselves would help build the schools. And they were wonderful, but they were segregated and they were for children. The citizenship schools were for adults, and they were not buildings. They were concepts held in very informal places. So there is a difference, and I would love to write about the Rosenwald schools, but that's not my topic here. The freedom schools, when we talk about freedom schools, they're mostly the schools that were established in Mississippi during what's called Freedom Summer in 1964. And these were, again, informal schools, mostly for children, but also for adults. And they were based upon the concept of the citizenship schools. And you had activists like Bob Moses, who spearheaded the freedom schools, who worked closely with Septima Clark. So you see a symbiosis, but they're not exactly the same.
Yeah, because a lot of them were for kids, and these citizen education project schools, yes, as they came to be known, because eventually they did fall under the umbrella of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
No, right? Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Sorry, the SCLC. Okay. And so they were, they were coordinated with Dr. King. And as a, yes, matter of fact, the White Citizens Councils and the FBI and others used Dr. King's association with it. There's a famous photograph, mm-hmm, that was taken somewhat surreptitiously at the Freedom Schools at the Highlander School with Dr. King. And for years, they published that photograph saying, here's Dr. King with a bunch of communists. That, yes, was the accusation of the Highlander schools. And that did no small share of damage to Dr. King for years. Right?
Yes, it did. He was hounded by that. It was taken by a spy sent by one of these segregation commissions, this one particularly from Georgia. And that lie that this was a communist training School was used to smear Dr. King and the movement and Highlander for many, many, many years. And if you switch out communist, though often DEI is called now communist, or woke, if you just switch those names, you see that same use of a smear campaign being implemented right now. So, you know, I wrote this story because I think it's really important history. It's important for us to know about these people, but I didn't expect it to come out at this moment, or that we would be experiencing and living through this moment when so many parallels to what was used as opposition to civil rights and to equality is being dug up and used today.
Yeah, and the parallels are striking and horrifying. This assault on DEI from the administration, which is now, you know, pervasive not just in government, but in outside of government, corporate America, academic America, you name it. Part of the argument is we don't want to teach this uncomfortable history because it'll make white children feel bad. I mean, I had Representative Andy Harris on this show a couple of years ago saying that exact thing. We're not going to, you know, fill these poor white kids with a guilt complex. But boy, these are the stories that are so important to understand. Including the fact that there was, you know, a number of forward-thinking progressive white people who were very much in concert with the black activists who were trying to change things, and it's centered on voting. You know, it's the voting was the fundament upon all of this activity. It ended up stopping. They stopped them in 1970. Racism wasn't over by 1970, but it just was it something that could no longer, that the SCLC could no longer sustain? Why do you think they stopped doing it?
The citizenship schools were still active until then. But again, because these were teaching illiterate people, for the most part, to pass the literacy tests. And after 1965, one of the great accomplishments of the Voting Rights Act is there were no literacy tests. So its fundamental goal had been met. The fact that it was teaching how to become a citizen was lost when they ended, but it took on new life as many people associated with the citizenship schools ran for office and became the first black office holders in the South.
This has been an archive edition of Midday. We've heard a conversation with the Baltimore-based author Elaine Weiss about her latest book, Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. That's it for us today. You can hear past episodes of Midday online and at WIPR.org by subscribing to our podcast or by checking us out on the WIPR app. If you have an idea for a show that you'd like us to do here on Midday, drop us a line and let us know. The address is midday@WIPR.org. On behalf of all my colleagues here at Midday, thanks very much for listening to our show on the radio or online. We very much appreciate your interest and attention to our work. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.